You will find the text of my sermon this morning in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and at verse 51. 1 Corinthians 15 at verse 51. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. The Bible often begins important announcements with this word, behold, or lo, sometimes lo and behold. It is one of the ways in which the Bible draws attention to something which is very important. It is like the ringing of a bell to draw our attention away from our own thoughts to something which is extremely necessary for us to attend to. Now, the Apostle Paul here is telling us about a mystery. A mystery. These are his words. Behold, he says, verse 51, I show you, or I tell you, or I reveal to you, a mystery. Now, we need to know what this word mystery means when it is found in the Bible. It has a completely different meaning when it is found in ordinary literature. We sometimes hear people talk about a book or a novel which is a mystery novel. And that means to say probably it's to do either with ghosts or with detectives or something. Crime in some shape or form, or the supernatural. And that's not at all what this word mystery means in the Bible. Let me tell you what it does mean in the Bible. In the Bible, the word mystery means a truth which could never be known to us or by us unless God had given us a special revelation of it in the Bible. I'll put that another way. A mystery is something which the mind of man could never have known if God had not shown it to us in the Bible. Now, there are several mysteries like this, many mysteries indeed. Let me take just one or two examples so that you see the point illustrated. It is a mystery that we Gentiles have been made partakers of the grace of God through the gospel. In the Old Testament time, the Jews thought that because they were a special nation, that they were the only special nation. And they made this terrible mistake. They thought that the Gentiles, people like us, born outside Jewry, outside the Israel nation, that we were of no account in the things of God. It is therefore a mystery which God has revealed through the Apostle Paul that we too, who are not Jews by birth, may through Christ be saved and go to heaven. We call that the mystery of the Gentiles. Let me give you another example of this word mystery. It is a mystery that the Jewish people will one day be brought back into the Christian church after having been cast out for these 2,000 or so years. Nobody can know these things by a process of logic. Now, there are some things that you can know without the Bible and without God's revelation in the Bible. We can know instinctively that there is a God. We don't need the Bible to inform us that God exists. You only have to lift up your eyes to the heavens and see the wonder of creation, and instinctively you say, some great power has done all this. Again, up to a point, we instinctively know the difference between right and wrong. We don't need the Bible to tell us that we shouldn't kill people or commit adultery and so forth. We have an instinct which up to a point tells us what is right and wrong. I know it has limitations. But a mystery is not that kind of truth. A mystery is the kind of truth which no amount of instinct and no amount of logic could ever have brought a person to know, had God not revealed it to us in his word. So that's why it begins with the word behold. Paul is saying, this is something, my friends, well worth listening to, because it is one of the wonderful truths which God has revealed to us, and you could not know it any other way. Now, what is this mystery then here? What's it all about? Well, this mystery that Paul is talking about here concerns the resurrection of the body of the Christian in the last day. Now, we sometimes say to one another, don't we, as Christians, my soul has been saved. But we can say more than that. We can say, through Christ, my soul has been saved, and also my body has been saved. Because this is the mystery which Paul here is talking about. Not only will our soul, if we're Christians, go to heaven, but also our bodies, too, will be raised from the grave in the end, in the last day. This clearly is a mystery, because if you ever come to read the writings of the clever men who lived before the days of Christ, clever men in Greece and Rome and so on, who wrote their learned books called philosophies, you will see that they, none of them believed in the resurrection of the body. They had all sorts of shadowy ideas about life after death, most of them quite wrong. But they had some notion that after death something happens to us. But none of them had any idea that the body will rise again from the grave. This is a sheer mystery which only the Bible tells us. So that's why the apostle announces it in this way. All right. Let me come now to speak about the first part of this mystery. My text is in verse 51. Let me show you the first part of it. Verse 51. We shall not all sleep. That's the first part of the mystery. We shall not all sleep. What does that mean? It means that not all Christians at the end of the world will have died. When the end of the world comes, there will be Christians living who will never die. Because once the end of the world has come, then that is an end of everything, even death itself, so far as the believer is concerned. But, on the other hand, he says, many Christians will have died. And he uses this word sleep in reference to the death of a believer. Let me tell you why he uses this word sleep. He uses the word sleep concerning a believer's death because a believer's death is a lovely thing. It is a thing which he has no reason to be afraid of. When you go to bed at night, you're not afraid to drop off to sleep. You've all done it many times. Sometimes you've been so exhausted, you've been very, very thankful to drop off to sleep. Well, now that is why the Bible uses this word sleep of the death of a Christian. It is true that death is still our enemy, the last enemy. Yet as soon as a believer falls into a state of death, as a believer in Christ, his soul is at rest. His soul goes at once to glory. His soul is immediately made perfect in holiness and goes into the place of blessedness called paradise. And there the soul is with God, perfectly happy and awaiting the resurrection of the last day. You could put it this way: the soul is perfect but not complete. The soul is perfect in holiness as soon as it enters into glory, but the body to which the soul is attached, that body is still in the grave, and it awaits the last day. So says Paul in the first part of this mystery, there will be Christians at the end of the world who will be living and will never die. But most of the Christians, or many of them at any rate, will have died. So when the end of the world comes, there will be Christians in two conditions. There will be living Christians who will never die, and there will be dead Christians who have long since died. And this mystery, he says, concerns them both. I'll tell you what concerns them just in a moment. But I want to say this to you, dear friends, that if we are Christians, we have nothing to be afraid of in death. Was it yesterday or the day before we heard of a very eminent politician who had been in the cabinet of our nation, exceedingly gifted man and brilliant debater in the Highlands of Scotland, suddenly passed away. And we are sorry to hear that, and we sorrow with his family. But that reminds us how quickly even the greatest and most brilliant may suddenly pass from this scene of time. But if we are Christians, we have nothing to fear, because death is but a sleep to the believer. And the apostle says, some shall sleep, but not all, he says, not all. Now, when a Christian, my friends, when a Christian is afraid of death, it is because of ignorance. And when we fear death, it is because we don't believe enough what the Bible tells us about death for the Christian. I remember when I was a little child, very little, and was pushed about in a pram, I can remember there was a windmill not too far from where we lived. And I was terrified of the noise of this windmill. It made a sort of tinkling sound that was very disagreeable to me. I was terrified of the noise of this windmill as a little child. Now that fear was absolutely ridiculous. The windmill had no power to hurt me whatsoever. Now just so with death. Death has no power whatever to harm the Christian. And when the Christian is afraid of death, it is because he is allowing himself to forget the promises of God. And he allows himself to forget what death is to the believer. It is but a sleep. Now that's the first part of the mystery. We shall not all sleep. I come now to the second part of the mystery, which is more wonderful still. The second part is here in verse 51. But we shall all be changed. That is to say, when the end of the world comes, all Christians will suddenly undergo a change in their appearance. both the living Christians and also the dead. It will affect them both. Let's look at them in that order. The living Christian, as he goes about his work, he'll be doing all sorts of things. He'll be ploughing his field, or he'll be teaching in his classroom, or if he's a medical person, attending to the sick, or if he's a legal person, dealing with some matter of law, and all the other jobs that people will be doing at the end of the world, similar to what they do now. Suddenly, his whole body will be changed. And he will be glorious, bright, beautiful, and brought into a condition in which his body is immediately fitted for heaven. Similarly, the same thing will happen to the dead Christian. Let's take Abraham. Abraham's soul has been in heaven for something like 4,000 years, because he lived 2,000 years before Christ, and we are now 2,000 years or so after Christ. So Abraham died 4,000 years ago, roughly speaking, and his soul has been in glory all that time, and his body has been in the grave all that time. And of course Abraham's body has turned to dust. You can never identify it. Dust, and if the bones have survived the ravages of time, they must be so fragile they would tremble at a touch. But now, this is what the mystery tells us. When the end of the world comes, Abraham's body will immediately be reconstituted by God. All the dust will be brought together, and not only that, but he will be changed in his appearance, and his body will be bright like the very sun in glory, a body fitted for heaven. And something will occur at the same time. His soul, which has been in heaven all those centuries, will come down to be with the body again. And body and soul together, being now alive, and being the Abraham he was before, only more glorious, he will rise from the grave. And that will happen to you, if you are a believer. Whether you die in childhood, or in your mother's womb, or whether you die at 100 years of age, makes no difference. This mystery is true of all Christians. When the end comes, we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. This change will come about. Now the apostle tells us at verse 53 what this change will involve. Verse 53. This corruptible, he says, must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. That is to say, the thing which is true of us now, and will be true of us after death, will suddenly be reversed. You and I are mortal. It would be quite possible for one of us to be travelling home today, God forbid, but it would be quite conceivable that one of us travelling home could be killed in an accident. It's happening to somebody every day, somewhere. We're mortal, liable, that is, to die, and to die without a moment's warning. We are mortal and corruptible. But when this mysterious change comes about upon us, of which the apostle speaks, our bodies then will be brought into such a condition that they are mortal no more. They will never die again. The unbeliever will die twice. He will die in the sense that his body will go into the grave. But after the resurrection, when he is raised from the grave, he will go into a deeper death called the second death, which is still more terrible than anything he's ever known before. But the Christian will not, because the Christian is united to Christ and his sins forgiven, and because he is a child of God, his body and soul together will be brought into a condition in which he can never die again. His mortal part will become immortal, and his corruptible part will become incorruptible. This is the nature of the change. Let me put that to you in this form. Supposing a person in this world had an extremely beautiful body, whether a man who was very handsome and athletic, or a woman who's very beautiful in her body. That beauty and that handsomeness will be as nothing compared with the greater beauty and the more perfect glory which will belong to that man and to that woman when they rise again from the dead. If I might use a home illustration, even the most handsome people who've ever lived, these Hollywood film stars, let us say, if they were to be put side by side with you in your resurrection body, these Hollywood film stars with their shining bodies, they would drop back in horror, feeling themselves to be as unclean as a peat stack, besides the glory which will shine from you as a Christian. This is the promise. And this is the comfort we have, that some of us know very well that we do not qualify for excellence in physical appearance. Perhaps our bodies are weak in some way or disabled in some way. All the weaknesses and disagreeable things about our bodies now will completely vanish when we come to this resurrection day. And of course, little babies dying in their mother's womb, if they were amongst the elect, they will have full-grown bodies, as though they had lived for 50 or 60 years in this life. And those who have had any kind of handicap or weakness of the body or of the mind in this life, when they rise from the dead as Christians in the end of the world, all infirmity and all weakness will vanish, and they will be as perfect and glorious as the best. My friends, I say these things because this is the teaching that God gives to every Christian, and it is good to ponder these things. Why is it good to ponder these things? What is the help that this information and mystery give us? Well, I'll tell you. We live in a world where people are forever boasting. They're boasting of what they know. Clever men, philosophers, scientists, researchers, experts, academics, as they're called. They've got all their ideas as to how to put the world right. But they're not succeeding, are they? We never had so many clever men and women in the world putting the world right. But they haven't succeeded, have they? They haven't done it. And there's one thing that all the clever minds in the world have never been able to do. They have never been able to solve the problem of death. They can't do it. And they don't expect to be able to do it. Ah, but as a Christian, if you are a Christian, the problem of death is solved for you. How? Because of the promise of God. That God will lift you at last out of a state of death into a state of glory and resurrection. This is the promise. This is why this is so important. To be a Christian is the most important thing in the world. Better to be a Christian with this hope than to have all the learning of 10,000 academics dissolved into one and distilled into one. Because the Christian will overcome the world. Nobody else will. They'll take their learning with them. And they'll take their academic knowledge with them. We're not decrying learning and academic knowledge. What we're saying is it's inadequate. It's very important to have academic learning, of course. If you can get it, get as much as you can. But I'm saying it won't solve anything of itself. But to be a Christian means that this age-old problem of death is already solved. Now let me hurry on to tell you a little bit more from my text. Paul now explains to us how long it will take for this change to occur in the body of a believer. Now, you know, usually we are told that the world was in a state of evolution for millions of years, or billions. I don't believe a word of it. I have good reason to think that the world is no older than roughly 6,000 years. But that's not my subject just now. And I won't just be diverted from this. But the reason why people who believe in evolution talk about millions and billions of years is it gives you plenty of scope for imagination. If you talk about millions and millions of years, you've got a very wide scope in which all sorts of things can be imagined to happen. But the change, my friend, the change which will occur in your body when you're a Christian, at the end of the world, the change will not require millions of years or billions of years. How long will it take? Listen, the verses 52. We shall all be changed, says Paul. In 1,000 years? No, he doesn't say that. Does he say 10,000 years? No. He says in a moment. In a moment. Now, the Greek word there is worth knowing. It's the word atom. The word atom. In a twinkling of an eye. Here's another way in which he puts it. In a moment, in a twinkling of an eye. And the word moment there in Greek is the word atom. Why is it called atom? Well, atom literally means something you can't split. Of course, we now know how to split an atom, but in Greek times they didn't think it was ever possible to split an atom. So the word atom is used meaning the shortest imaginable period of time. What we say often in common speech is in a flash. That would be a good translation. In a flash, the change will occur. In the twinkling of an eye. Well, you don't need me to tell you how long it takes to blink. Not very long. We can all do it by practice. Just one blink, and that's it. In that blink of time, says Paul, all Christians who have ever lived from the beginning of time right to the end, all of them will be instantaneously changed from being in their present condition of mortality to being in their future condition of immortality, glory, blessedness, and perfection. That's how long it will take, a split second. Now, this is so amazing that we ask ourselves, now, but how can God do all that so fast? Well, let me remind you of Jesus Christ when he was on the Mount of Transfiguration. Do you remember he had with him Peter and James and John on the Mountain of Transfiguration? Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, and parallel passages in Luke and in Matthew. And you can read it there. They were looking at Christ, and all of a sudden, in a moment, his whole appearance was changed. Before, he had looked just as you and I look, like an ordinary man, with ordinary clothes, nothing special or remarkable about him. But in an instant, suddenly, as they looked at Christ, he was glorious from head to foot. His clothes were whiter than white. No laundry on earth could ever improve on the quality of the whiteness, say the gospel writers. And he was glorious, his face was bright, glorious, shining, radiant, with the effulgence of brightness. Now that happened in a moment. And it is a picture to us, and a reminder to us that God can do anything, because he is God, and he will do this to your body in the day of the end of the world. If you are united to Christ by faith, your body will then be immediately, instantaneously, in a moment, and in a twinkling of an eye, changed. Now the next thing Paul tells us is when all this will happen. And he tells us, verse 52, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. So this will happen at the last trump or trumpet. Now the Bible calls it the last trumpet because there are many trumpets referred to in the Bible. There is a chapter in Numbers, it's Numbers chapter 10, verses 1 to 10. When you get home you can check on that, Numbers 10, 1 to 10, you'll see there's a whole section there dealing with trumpets. And these trumpets in the Old Testament were to be used for special purposes. When the priests blew on the trumpet in one way, then all the tribes of Israel had to gather together for a conference or a campaign of war, perhaps. When the priests blew in another way, then they had to prepare for battle and to go forth against the enemy, and so on. There were various blasts and sounds made on the trumpet. And that was true all through the Bible. Trumpets were used for this and that. But there is going to be a last trumpet. God's trumpet will blow at the end of history. God himself will either blow the trumpet with his own lips or command the archangel to blow it. It's not quite clear to me which of the two is the case, but in either case it is God who will initiate the sound, and the angel of God, if it is he who blows it, will blow the last sound of the trumpet, and that sound will bring history to an end. It will be the end of time, the end of history. Everything will be finished. It will be the end. Now that is the time, says Paul, when these wonderful things will happen to our body. When that trumpet sounds, as the trumpet is blowing and the blast of it is heard throughout the universe from one end to another, all the bodies of the Lord's people, the living and also the dead, will all be raised from their condition. The dead will be raised from the grave, the living will be transformed into the beauty of their resurrection body. And we are told here that there are four great changes which will occur. He's spoken about this a little earlier. Let me come to draw your attention to it at verse 42. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown in corruption. It is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body. So there are four great changes going to come upon our body. Comparing and contrasting our present condition with our resurrection state, these are the four things. First, our bodies are sown in corruption. That's what happens to the body when we die. It becomes rotten. It begins to moulder away, to decompose. It returns to the dust again. But the resurrection body is the opposite to that. The resurrection body will be raised in incorruption. The body is sown in dishonour. A dead body is not a nice thing to look at. In America they sometimes try to cover over that factor about the dead. They put lipstick on ladies' lips and powder on their cheeks, and they dress them in their nice clothes, and they put them sitting up in a chair or on a couch or perhaps sitting up in the coffin. They're trying to dress death up to make it look beautiful, but it isn't beautiful. Death is not a beautiful thing. Death is a dishonorable thing. Sin is the reason for death. But in the resurrection, the body which is dishonorable now will be shining in glory. soul in weakness, raised in power. And then the fourth thing is most wonderful of all. It is sown a natural body, but raised a spiritual body. Now pay attention to that. The Apostle Paul gives a special note at the end of verse 44. He explains that. He says there is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. What is he talking about? He means the body that we now have in this life is suited for life on earth. You are not an angel. And you are not meant to be an angel. Your body is fit for life in this world. All the powers and processes of the body you have, hands and feet and so on, eyes and ears, they're all suited for life in this world. By the way, what a lot of things these five fingers on each hand have to do all through life. What a wonderful thing the human hand is. Oh, what a creator we have. What a great God has given us these five fingers with which you can do all sorts of things, all our lifetime through. But the spiritual body is going to be different from this natural body. The spiritual body is a body which will fit us for life in heaven and life in glory. I hope we are not so gross as to imagine that our resurrection body will be absolutely the same in appearance as the body we have now, only perhaps 6 inches bigger and brighter. No, no, the body will be changed, tremendously changed. It's a mystery we cannot fathom, but the resurrection body will be far, far, far more glorious than we can imagine. And it will be absolutely fitted for life in glory. I don't suppose in heaven we need teeth or eyes or ears as we have them now or hands as we have them now. We can't imagine what the resurrection body is like, but we know it will be perfectly fitted for life in glory. And the Apostle Paul uses an illustration, and I think I better close with this, though there's so much more to be said, but let me bring in this illustration before I close. He uses this illustration about sowing and reaping. Look at verse 35. But some man will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? In other words, what will the shape of the body be like? What will the body look like? That's the question. And Paul says, you foolish person, that which thou sowest is not made alive, except it die. That which thou sowest not that body that shall be, but bare grain. And God gives it a body as it hath pleased him, and to every seed his own body. He's using there an illustration, and I have time just to open up the illustration before I must close. It's the illustration of sowing seed in the field. Let me imagine you are planting acorns because you want to have a wood or a small forest of oak trees. So if you want to produce oak trees from seed, then you must get acorns. As far as I know, I'm aware, you can't grow oak trees from anything but acorns. So you get your acorns and you plant them in the ground. And then in the course of months and years, they grow. Now anybody looking at an acorn wouldn't have the faintest idea what an oak tree looked like if they'd never seen one before. They might imagine that this acorn is going to grow into a huge acorn, but that would be ridiculous. Nothing of the kind. The shape of the acorn in no sense prepares you for the shape of the oak tree. And so it is with seeds generally. The shape of our body now doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the shape of our resurrection body. But what we do know is it will be a spiritual body, perfectly, ideally, consummately well suited and fitted for dwelling in the immediate presence of God. There shall be no need for the light of the sun, nor of the moon. God will be our light. We shall dwell in his immediate presence, and we shall enjoy him forever and have such a body that we shall, in a mysterious way, be able to draw all our strength and nourishment immediately from God Himself. He will feed us, and He will fill us with unspeakable delights and glories, so that at His right hand, says Psalm 16, our pleasures evermore. My dear friends, this is the mystery of the resurrection of the body, and every believer will come to this condition. Don't you pity the unbeliever? His body will rise from the dead in the last day in shame and ugliness and dishonor, and to be cast down into eternal destruction because of his unpardoned sins. And let me say as I close, if you're not a Christian here today, young men, young women, boys and girls, and older people, make sure of one thing, that Jesus is your Savior. And if you do, this mystery will be true for you. When the trumpet sounds, you will rise in glory to be forever with Christ.